Okay. Thanks of all. Yeah, on behalf of the organization, apologies for not having the slides there. So we'll be having the slides there until we can actually fix them there, which means that some of my slides will be a little bit hard to see. Yeah, this is not much I can do. Maybe the guy with the camera there can take some pictures and then hand the camera around or something like that. I don't know, but we'll try to do what we can anyway. Yeah, first of all, what will be in this talk? Because, the room is quite full. I'm happy about that. But if you find out that you might be in the room in the wrong room from the content, then you still have time to get to the other talk. This talk is about long live PKI's dead, long live our PKI. Our PKI as in a small PKI purpose build for what we intended it to do. So first of all, I'm going to answer the question, why did we decide to build a small PKI? What did we build up in the end? How did we do it? Well, we decided to do a Microsoft PKI infrastructure. Now, with the how question, I've got a small raise of hands. Who's familiar with what's really inside a PKI infrastructure here? Okay. I guess that means that I've got some coverage of some stuff that might seem a little bit basic, but given the raise of hands I just had, I will cover it anyway. I will share some of our mistakes with the main purpose so that you don't have to make those same mistakes again. And then I'll go to the PKI is dead part, explaining why PKI as we know it actually sucks. If you want to know who I am, my name is Frank Bredijk. My details are on here. Obviously, that will be a little bit hard to read in the background, so come up later and grab one of my cards. Why did we decide we needed our own public key infrastructure? Well, I work for Schuberg Phyllis, and we manage customers' IT environments for them. They are mission-critical IT environments, which means we built them in isolation. They're all self-contained, self-supporting, and typically consist of a test acceptance and production environment and then a management network where everything is managed from. So if I sit in the office and I want to do management, I first have to hop on from our office network onto our general management network. From there, I have to hop onto the customer-specific management network, and from there, I can go to the test acceptance or production environment. And luckily, we don't have more than one customer, because otherwise, as a company, we would have a hard time. So with multiple customers, this hopping through networks is multiple occurring. And if these customers are primarily Windows-based, that means that they have slightly different security policies. Customers A security policy is not going to be nothing like customer C security policy. And customer C security policy is going to look like customer B security policy, but is not quite customer D security policy. So that means you have different password expiries, password requirements, 2 capitals, 1 capital, 12 characters, 15 characters, 7 characters. Yes, 7 characters. But essentially, every time you hop from one network to the other network, you have to authenticate. Now, like I said, we had different expiries for each and every customer. So every ellipse that you see there is going to be a Windows domain. And that Windows domain and then the expiry happening basically means that your passwords expire at random intervals. And sometimes you haven't visited an environment in over a month. So it might not actually be your previous password, but the password before that. And that can only lead to one thing. Confusion, confused administrators who don't know how to get from one network to the other anymore, don't know what their credentials are anymore. So, not really a good thing. So what did we decide we need? We thought we needed smart card authentication. It's got a number of advantages if you run in this multiple credential world. You only have one smart card per user. You authenticate to that smart card, so you only have one PIN to remember. you can actually forward smart cards over RDP, which is extremely handy if you do Windows administration. You can use them to do cross-domain authentication. And you don't need to have domain controller interconnectivity when you do the authentication. Unlike when you do Windows domain trusts, which suck, because you need connectivity from every single node that you authenticate on to your domain controller. So certificates work as a basis of trust. Now, this is my certificate of identity in the real world. It's what I use when I go from the Netherlands to countries like France, like Poland. Well, I don't need to actually show them on the border because of the Schengen agreement, but I still, if I need to identify myself here, I show this certificate. PKI certificates are not different. They're a digital proof of identity from one system to the other. But the key thing to remember is that it's all about identity. This tells you who I am. It doesn't tell you if I should have been here, if I should be able to open a bank account, if I could work here, if I could do whatever. It only tells you that I am who I am if I look something like this picture. And they had to make me take off my glasses, so a little bit. So what is a certificate? What is a digital certificate? A digital certificate is a bit of information about me. So who am I? And it contains my public key. Now, public-private key pair is a key pair of two keys that basically anything you encrypt with the one key can be decrypted with the other and vice versa. So I can give out one key to you, you can encrypt messages to me, and I can decrypt it with my private key without having to share information that I don't want to share. A certificate is a signed copy of that information. So it's a signed copy of my public key with some identifying information signed with the private key of somebody else. So somebody testifies that, hey, he says he's Frank, I've verified that he's Frank, and this is his public key, I've also verified that, I'll sign for that. Now, how do you know when to trust such a signature? Well, we've got certificate chains for that. A certificate chain means that my PKI certificate, my digital certificate is signed by a certificate authority. That certificate authority has its own certificate. That certificate is signed by another certificate authority, and this can go on for quite some while. And then in the end, it's signed by a root certificate authority. Now, the root certificate authority is where the buck stops. It has nobody to vouch for its own identity, for its identity, but himself. So what he does, he creates a self-signed certificate. And a self-signed certificate basically means I'm going to tell you that I'm me and you just have to trust me. Originally, this is what we had thought up, and I'm going to talk through this slide because I realize you can't see it up there. So we thought, okay, this is our engineers. We'll make a root CA for our engineers. We'll have a sub CA there that we're going to issue the certificates from. And we're going to make sure that if we log on to a customer environment here on the right, that CA is going to be trusted. Then we also have another class of engineers, another class of employees, which are conveniently called other employees. So we're going to create a CA for them just for the office. Create a sub-CA for the office, give everybody who works here a certificate from the office CA, and just trust the engineering CA there. And then if customers want to have their own CA infrastructure, it can happily coexist alongside. Sounds like a plan, but it was wrong, because there I was thinking about authentication. I was thinking about the difference of rights between an engineer and a non-engineer. But all animals are equal, in the sense that they are identified in the same way. I'm going to check exactly the same documents, I'm going to make exactly the same claims about engineering employees than I'm going to make as about non-engineering employees. So keep it simple, stupid. Try to make it as simple as possible. We just got one root CA for Schuberg employees with a sub CA that issues the certificate, which is going to be trusted in customer environments. And if a customer wants to have his own PKI infrastructure, that'll be fine. Now, another thing you have to worry about when you build a PKI infrastructure is protection of keys. Keys are just random bits of data, and we all seen the examples of how easy it is to lose bits of data. Now, in case of a key, that would not be good. So how do you protect a key? I think Jacob and his team showed that once you load a key into memory, there's actually no way of protecting it. It was the cold boot attacks. So for PKI infrastructures, that's another function of the smart card. A smart card is basically a mini computer you connect to your computer. And it serves as a protected environment to store your key in. So you have this protected memory area where you got certificates, public keys, private keys, and maybe other things you want to store in there. And at the bottom, you've got a smart card operating system. And the smart card operating system is there to protect your key material. And it's there to enforce authentication. So to use the smart card, you have to enter a PIN. If that PIN has the right level, you can actually access the keys in the sense that certain private keys you can only use. You can't actually read them from the smart card. So if I want to encrypt something with my private key, I actually have to send it over to the smart card, say encrypt this with private key A, and the encrypted string comes back out of the smart card into my machine for me to use. If I want to decrypt a bit of information that was sent to me encrypted with my public key, I go send it to the smart card, say decrypt with private key, and I get the plain text back. So at no time these keys actually reside in memory where they can be stolen. You want something similar for servers, but you want it more robust, you want it more powerful because you're going to do more key operations on the server than you're going to do on a per user basis. And that's why vendors sell hardware security modules. Now, if you think about hardware security modules, basically think smart card for servers on steroids. It's basically a giant smart card that you insert into the machine. Again, it's got this bit of protected memory where you store key material. It's got its own OS where you authenticate to it and which regulates which keys you can use and who can manipulate the key data. Sorry? Ah, sure. Is that better? Is that okay for other people as well?
I'll tell them later on, you know.
Okay. I will put these slides, I'm sure the organization will put them online. So they will be able to download. I'll put them online at cupfighter.net as well. Where was I? Yeah. So it's got its own OS with its own set of authentication rules. And it goes a little bit further than smart cards because it actually uses smart card authentication for its authentication mechanism. And it doesn't trust the operating system. So instead of plugging the smart card reader via USB into your machine, there's actually often a plug on the back of the hardware security module where you actually physically plug in the card reader into the hardware security module. And you can do nifty stuff, like if I've got four administrators, at least two have to be present before we can manipulate key material, or three, or two out of five, or three out of five, whatever you decide to set up. And they come in two flavors, network security modules and the printed circuit board that I just shown. So basically, the printed circuit board, it's just one card per machine, you plug it in, and it starts doing its stuff after you program it. And then the network type, you hook it up to the network, you program it, you put a key on the server, you authenticate the server to the network security module, to the hardware security module. And multiple servers can share a hardware security module. You can partition it off. Two of them can keep each other in sync, so you have failover across sites. And they sound more advanced, and that's why they're more expensive. So we decided to go for the cheap option and to actually put a circuit board in each and every one of our single CAs.
Which bus are you using?
We decided to go for the nCipher card.
Right, what's the Which bus are you using?
It's a PCI bus.
PCI bus.
Yeah, it's a PCI card.
Can actually was proven that it can be stooped.
Yeah, but yeah, it's proven that it can be snooped, but it's used to send clear text memory to RAM, which can be snooped as well. So yeah, at some point you have to start trusting your own computers.
API rootkits, it's not really, you know, easy to trust it.
No, but I don't think you should use your CA to serve to Facebook. Yeah, like I already indicated on the slide, I think in the end we made a bad choice. We should have gone for the networked HSMs. Why? Well, our ultimate motivation was money. Turns out there's no good redundancy for Microsoft certificate authorities. There's just no way that you can set them up so that that if you have two and one goes down, the other one completely takes over the functions of the first one. Yes, you can still issue certificates, but that's usually not the time critical part. The time critical part is issuing the revocation lists. But each CA will have its own certificate database, and I'll get back to that subject later, which means that the one CA, if it goes down, the other one cannot generate a certificate revocation list for the CA that went down. So how do you do failover? Well, one of the things that could really help you implement failover on Microsoft CAs is virtualization. Unfortunately, it's a bit hard to put a circuit board into a virtual machine. So yeah, we couldn't do that. What did we do? Well, we decided to do another poor man's failover solution, is actually make this machine do a net boot. So we or a SAN boot. So we put in an iSCSI interface card, made the machine diskless in essence, and just decided to boot it off the SAN. So if the machine dies in one data center, we'll fail over the SAN image, boot the machine, boot another machine from there, which already has a programmed HSM on board, and resume operations from there. Hardware security modules, do you need them? I think it's a risk analysis. If you want to do something official, somebody somewhere is going to demand that you use an HSM. But for instance, your offline root CA, we've implemented that as a virtual machine that has no network cards, is stored on a TrueCrypt partition, on an external drive, and is stored in an external location. I think it's pretty unlikely that that's ever going to get a key compromise. So I'm not going to recommend using an HSM for that, especially not if this thing is only going to be online once a year. Now, certificate revocations. You do need to revoke your certificates. I recently got this new passport, so my old one got revoked in a very crude manner. But you need to be able to do the same with the certificates you issue yourself. You get people leaving your organizations, people sort of lose tokens because they're really tiny things that poke out of the side of your machine and you're going to get them out and lose them somewhere. Keys maybe get compromised. There's a whole bunch of reasons why you might want to revoke certificates. And to do that, we used certificate revocation lists. Now, there's another online certificate protocol status. Yeah, there's another protocol which does online certificate status checks. We decided not to use that because it's a more complex protocol and this was easier to implement and had all the features that we want. So what's a certificate revocation list? It's basically a list of serial numbers, dates that they were revoked, reasons why they were revoked with a small category at least, and then a validity date, and it's signed by the private key of the certificate authority. It's a part where I can't see the screen now, they're giving me the problems. So you can only revoke certificates which are in your certificate database. So if you ever get a certificate database crash, you can resume normal CA operations and all your certificates will remain valid. The only thing is if that person ever leaves your organization, you cannot revoke his certificate anymore. The other thing is that the protocol says that if the revocation list is unavailable, authentication should fail. It's not must, it should. But yeah, it's still pretty bad if you can't generate your certificate revocation list and you all of a sudden have 100 engineers who can't log in anymore. So where do you publish this list? Microsoft CAs, especially enterprise CAs, automatically publish it in Active Directory. The other thing you can do is put it on a place that's reachable by HTTP by just about anybody, and it's public information anyway. So a public website is a good place to put it, and that's where we did it. Now, how often do you refresh? Yeah, that really depends. There's one thing to consider, though. There's two parameters with the revocation time. One is the renewal time, which means I'm going to renew this list every 24 hours, for instance, or 48 hours or every week. The other one is your overlap time. And your overlap time has to be smaller than your renewal time, cannot be longer than 12 hours. And yeah, what it means is that the renewal time plus the overlap time is the time that the CA is going, that the certificate revocation list is going to be cached or is going to be valid. It also means that that's the best case scenario you have for restoring your CA if it goes tits up. Unfortunately, usually Murphy says that things don't go down at the best convenient time, they go down at the worst convenient time. So that would mean they go down during generation of the certificate revocation list, which means that you're only going to have those 12 hours to restore your machine. So that's something to really consider when you build an infrastructure like this. Be prepared to restore functionality within 12 hours. As a trick, you could generate an empty certificate revocation list with a very long lifetime at the beginning and store it somewhere safe and put it up on your website if something goes wrong. But yeah, that means all the certificates you previously revoked are all of a sudden valid again. Remember when you make this decision that it's about authentication, it's not about authorization. So if you don't want somebody to access certain resources in your company, yes, you should revoke their certificate, but really what you should do is take their permissions away, because that's usually immediate. Certificates have a lifetime. Certificates don't remain valid for the eternity of time. If I look at my first registration in my mother's passport, nobody could use it anymore to identify me, because it says I'm this big and have a baby face. So you have to set a lifetime. What's a reasonable lifetime depends on your organization. 1 year, 2 years is a typical lifetime. But remember that the CA that's above that has to have a certificate that's at least twice the validity of the certificates it's going to issue. So if the subject is going to have 1 year, you have to make sure that after 1 year, you can still issue certificates which have a validity of a year. Because if your CA is only valid for another year and you issue a certificate for 10 years, that means that certificate will expire, will not validate anymore after a year, because the CA certificate that issued it expired. So typically what you do for a CA is you take twice the lifetime and renew at half the lifetime. The CA above that, and above that, and above that. And that gets big pretty quickly, as we all know. So really, you shouldn't have too long CA change anyway. Backup and restore is another one to consider. First of all, backup and restore is really handy when you're building a public key infrastructure for the first time, because just regard the first one you build as a prototype and count for it to fail. I know mine did. Actually, the second did as well. So really make sure that you build one to erase it and then build another one to erase it. And then only when you're sure you've done it right, actually start issuing certificates for public use. What do you need to back up? Your certificate database, your key material, and your settings. Important utilities there, search util for the certificate database and for the key material if you're not using an HSM. If you are using an HSM, you want to use the utilities that came with your HSM. And regedit to export the settings. Import the settings, well, RTFM isn't always a good thing. It's quite often a good advice to do read the manual, but then sometimes you have to think, well, why at some point we lost our Active Directory registration for our CAs? And I thought, okay, that's no problem. I've got the book, did the backup according to the book, so now I'm going to get the book and do the restore. Turned out that didn't work. Why? It's divided into three stages. Stage one is the initial setup. Stage two is where the Active Directory registration happens. And stage three is where the rest of the setup, what actually means setup, is finished. When you take your certificate database and your certificate and your private keys and you restore it, and you then import your registry file. So here you go to setup stage one, then you abort the setup, you import all this stuff, then you read back your registry settings. And one of the things it does is actually set setup state to 3. So it completely skips the generation of the AD registration of the CA. So it took me a couple of times to figure out what was going on, and then I actually just rebuilt the stuff. Luckily, I had written down all the settings that I made. So that's another recommendation that I have for you if you're ever going to do this yourself. Use pen and pencil to write down what settings you make, or word processor. And then there's managing certificates. If you've got a big group of people that you manage certificates for, localhost cert SVR is not going to be the most handy tool to manage your certificates. Or is the Certificate Authority Management MMC plugin. You need something like Microsoft Certificate Lifecycle Manager, or we use Aladdin smart cards. You might use Aladdin's token management system. What's the key difference? Well, both are relatively easy to set up, but require some study. They can handle large groups of users. The only thing is that Microsoft is a generic solution, so you have to program the tokens yourself. And yeah, if you don't want to do that, you want the system to do that for you, go for the token management system of the vendor. Also, if you want to use special features like, for instance, this one has one-time password integrated into it. That's not going to be very visible, is it? But if you want to use tokens that have one-time password in them or encrypted USB drives, so any special features, you have to use the vendor's token management system. External trust. You want your certificates to be trusted externally, because living on an island is fine, but yeah, there is an outside world, and you should not forget that. So this is what we originally thought would be a good idea. We'll just have our normal CA infrastructure, and then for our intermediate certificate authority, we'll just generate two signing certificates. So one signed by our own internal root, the other one signed by a trusted third-party root certificate. Turned out this was a very big wild goose chase. And for those of you who can't see it, this is a picture of Goose. It actually turns out that you can't, in a Microsoft world, generate a valid certificate chain that works in both situations. Theoretically, it's all possible. I mean, you just take the CSR, the certificate signing request that you generated when you built the intermediate CA, send it off to both CAs, you'll get valid CA certificates back. So you have two valid CA certificates that will both validate, will both work. One will work for external parties, one will work for internal parties. The trick is, which one are you going to install in the intermediate CA as the CA certificate? If you're going to install your own root CA, it means every email that you send out with Outlook will actually be signed by a certificate chain that ends with your own private root CA. If you install the public root CA and use that, then any smart card login certificate that you generate and put on the stick will actually have a certificate chain that ends with the public root CA, and that's not the CA you want to trust for smart card authentication on your platform, because that means you trust the entirety of everybody who's ever been signed by that root CA. So in the end, what we had to do was actually put in a second intermediate root CA that we use just to generate email signing certificates. Link that to the trusted third party and use the other CA for our smart card login. And it has some advantages. It means that you can actually have policy differences and different key assurance mechanisms for the two CAs. It also means that you unfortunately will need two HSMs. Now, we like redundancy, so this would have meant that we would have actually needed four HSMs, which would have made those four HSMs as expensive as had we bought two network HSMs to start with. So in retrospect, yes, we should have gone for network HSMs for that reason as well. So it sounds like a pretty complex and a lot of details. Does it actually work? Yes, it does. I mean, I'm logged in with my smart card certificate here, and when I go to customer environments, I don't actually know which password I have there anymore. You can actually set Microsoft operating systems up so that they generate a random password for you and you don't have to know it anymore. So why is the system PKI not perfect? Because this story sounds pretty much perfect. One of the problems that we have in the PKI system as we know it now is that we have far too many root certificate authorities. I opened up Firefox, I went to the certificate store and I counted out the number of certificate authorities. Now, is there anybody in the back row who hasn't been able to read the number, willing to guess how many CAs there are in Firefox? Just a wild guess. 2,000 is a bit much, but it's actually 216 certificate authorities. In the Microsoft Root CA program, how many organizations do you think have convinced Microsoft, and I think it's done by paying them money, to have one or more CA in Windows? More. It's 104 organizations having a total of 285 certificate authorities, and those are root certificate authorities. That's not counting all the intermediates signed by the certificate authorities. I hope it will, but it will break a major part of the internet. Yeah, but the CAs still need to be there until their certificates expire.
Sure. Now it will consolidate in a few years because everybody is supposed to buy a new Windows and new computer every year.
Yeah, but still that new version of Windows needs to support those 104 organizations. Or those 285 CAs still need to be in there. Because if they take them out, parts of the internet will stop working. Or at least people will get a user and then just click until they have internet or click until they have porn. The scary thing to remember about this is that any of those 285 CAs that is in Windows can actually certify anything. The Dutch government is allowed to generate a web certificate for any website, regardless if it ends in .nl or not. And that's true for anyone on that list. Now, I don't know about you, but I would be really suspicious if I found out that my bank that I use in the Netherlands tomorrow was certified by a chamber of commerce in China. That would be a major... If they all of a sudden switched from a Dutch CA to a Indian CA or a Chinese CA for their certificate, my browser won't tell me. It just says it's a valid certificate.
That you get prompt that the CA that was used previously was changed.
Nope.
No.
No, you don't.
That
was a proposition. It's never worked that way. And if you do get, I mean, how many users will just click until they get porn, or click until they can pay, or click until they can get internet? I mean, how many users are actually dedicated enough to...
Yeah, but they deserve to be stolen from.
Well, I don't know. I don't think my mother deserves to be stolen from. Do you?
I'm sorry, you should teach your mother better.
Oh, okay. So my grandmother. CAs. In the end, we have to remember that most CAs that are in there are commercial organizations. That means that any certificate they sell is revenue to them. And any assurance they do, anything they do to look into your identity is actually overhead. It's cost. Now, becoming a reseller, I mean, type in become SSL reseller, SSL certificate reseller in a browser. It's so easy. Only thing required is a credit card. And that means you can start buying certificates for about $40. Now, I don't know, but I guess there's not much validation that you can do for $40. CAs have been attacked. I mean, Dan's going to be here later today. He did some work. Moxie's pretty much... Yeah, he's already declaring SSL as to being so last year. Mike Sussman, others. I mean, there have been plenty of attacks on SSL, and it's just... Time and time again, the system was owned. One of the things that I found funny about Moxie's talk at Black Hat last year is that he stated that actually parts of the X509 standard were lost for a while. When they made the new version, they forgot about 50% of it, and nobody noticed, and they approved the new standard, and then they had to issue another version with the 50% added again so that the standard would be consistent again. It's a complex beast. It's going to bound up to have problems. So what are possible solutions? Well, fortunately, I don't have the silver bullet solution. DNSSEC could certainly play a role in it, in terms of that you could use your DNS records to anchor which CAs you do business with, which CAs are actually allowed to sign your certificate, or maybe even put the serial numbers or the fingerprints of your own certificates in there, so that when you go to www.mybank.com, you know, and you get a certificate, you have a trusted source where you can look up what that certificate is. Problem I have with it, which Dan seems to have a little bit less, is that the roots zone of DNSSEC is actually run by the US government. And he's a US citizen, I'm not, let's put it that way. IPv6 may help, may not help. It's got mandatory support for IPsec. Unfortunately, a null cipher is still an allowed cipher. TOFU, trust on first use, could be a system. It's what we use for our SSH public and private keys and our SSH server keys. It's just the first time that I log into there, it's like, okay, do you want to add this to your cache? I do. I don't have any basis to do it or not do it. And the next time I log into that system and I get a different key, I get a warning. Another one that's very interesting, it's a Firefox plugin called Perspectives. It actually takes trust on first use but expands on it. And it has a number of notaries around the internet who will independently connect to the same website you're connecting to, get the key ID from that, and then you can check, like, okay, I'm seeing this key ID when I connect to a website. Is this actually key ID you trust? Is that the same key ID you're seeing? And if it is, then you're probably okay. And it will actually make more intelligent decisions than yourself about websites when you get a Firefox certificate warning plugin. Yeah, but I want to come to an end and draw a conclusion. I'm not sure how we're doing time-wise. Oh, okay. Building a PKI is not rocket science. It's got a lot, the devil's in the details. It's got a lot of details. You have to plan it carefully, but it's doable. And these things can actually be very useful to you if you want to. PKI as we know it from SSL, I think the system is dying. It's getting too big. It's getting too big to be trusted anymore. So do you still trust it? I think that's an individual decision to make. I don't think you have any other usable system at the moment to really put your trust in. But like I said, small systems are still useful. With that, I ask you if you've got any questions.
Do you compare your product to OpenCA?
I'm not building a product, so this is not a product pitch. I used standard components from standard vendors. I just used what's built in a Microsoft product. OpenCA is, other than the fact that it's run by different people, by a different set of rules, just another CA out there, just as CA Cert. So it suffers, in a sense, from the same problems. The good thing about, for instance, CA Cert, I don't know OpenCA that well. I know CA Cert better. The good thing about CA Cert is that it actually requires you to have multiple assurers make a claim about your identity before you can start issuing certificates. So I think it's a little bit better fix. It's got better validation. Unfortunately, it's not in every browser. I don't know what the validation rules are from OpenCA. So, but really the key difference between what I did and what OpenCA did is I didn't build a CA infrastructure to replace any of the other 285 that are out there. I just built something for me to make a small problem very easy, and in that small problem I have a good grip about who I want to trust and who I should trust. Yeah?
Maybe a small contribution to your interesting lecture. Well, have you encountered the problems with using not the root CAs while the subordinate CAs? I have encountered some during my work. That there is a piece of software, for example, 3 years ago, the problem touched actually well, common piece of software, which was free radius. It was unable to validate users which were using subordinate CAs. It was quite an issue, you know. And there is still some piece of software on the market which cannot do any use of subordinate CAs. So well,
okay.
As a remark,
it's,
yeah. So
it's good to know.
We should check it out. Yeah.
I haven't encountered any issues where subordinate CAs gave a problem to me. So I might have been lucky in that respect. With regards to free radius, kick them in the butt, tell them they're wrong, because they are wrong.
It's an unsolved issue.
Yeah. So they solved it, luckily.
Yes. Past three years earlier, yes.
Yeah.
It was an
okay.
issue, but there's still some software in the market which has difficulties in using subordinate CAs.
Yeah, we have come across a couple of funny things when building the CA, and I've put some of those things that are too long to discuss here. I've put them on cupfighter.net, which is our coworker blog, so you can find some of the other war stories there.
Okay.
Any other questions, remarks? Okay. Thanks for your attention.